The total amount of student loans I owe is $119,397.
I owe over $40,000.
I had about $25,000 in student loan debt.
I'm currently in $60,000 in debt.
I have $24,000 in student loans.
This is The Cost of Opportunity, a podcast about student loan debt from the Cap Times. I'm Caitlin Farrell. Last month, the Cap Times hosted a panel discussion on student debt as a part of our monthly Cap Times Talks series. In this episode of the podcast, we're going to share portions of that conversation. It's centered around the question, what should Wisconsin do about student loan debt? We heard from Derek Kindle, Director of Financial Aid at UW-Madison, Ellie Brooker, a UW-Madison graduate student who researches student debt, Annalise Eicher with the liberal research group One Wisconsin Now, and Brad O'Brien, the education manager at GreenPath Financial Wellness, a nonprofit that offers free one-on-one debt counseling. Early on in the event, we got into a discussion about how student debt affects other kinds of personal finance issues and whether current levels of student debt are a crisis. Derek said he doesn't think it's a crisis, or as dire as some advocates and the media make it sound.
Crises going on. I don't know if I would classify this overall as a national crisis. I think it is a very real challenge for people who face debt, even if it's a smaller debt for those who didn't obtain a degree or a credential. But I don't know that I would classify this as a national crisis. That doesn't mean I don't think it's a challenge that we need to resolve and we need to get some policy solutions in there. We need to get additional funding at the state level for institutions and that there are all kinds of things that we could do with affordability and that we could do with refinancing. But I don't know if I would consider it a crisis, particularly given where we are as a nation. If we're looking at the debt and for college, for education, and provided that you do get a degree, this is one of the best investments you can make. So all the research points to people who have a degree, have some type of credential, will on the whole earn more than their counterparts who went to college and didn't earn a credential, or those who didn't even graduate from high school. Meaning that it's a sound investment on the whole. It's a sound investment, and you think about sort of the average debt in Wisconsin, about $28,000. You have some people who buy cars or lease cars for that amount. Of course, you have homes that cost a whole lot more. And if you're thinking about sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we don't say at all that we think housing en masse should be free. We don't think cars en masse should be free. There are some arguments about free education, particularly for those in need, but we have a very different approach when we say, should we borrow for education versus should we borrow for things that we know that everyone will need always? Food, clothing, shelter, and some mode of transportation if they're working. But I think if we look at it in that way, we do have to question whether we consider this to be an actual crisis or whether we consider this to be a serious problem or a serious challenge.
Brad disagreed. He said it was a crisis, particularly in how the debt can shape a borrower's personal finances and create an overwhelming sense of shame and isolation.
So at GreenPath, we meet with a lot of people on a regular basis who are really struggling financially, including with student loans. And I think even just the first two starts of this conversation just shows how complex this is. It's not just people who have graduated dealing with their student loans and their inability to feel like they can buy homes and buy cars and save for retirement, but it's also lower income people who, you know, end up not graduating and then have default rates like 50 to 75% at private schools. You know, it's a broader conversation that we need to have. And I think part of it is that, you know, when we talk with people on a regular basis, I mean, especially people with student loans, but just the general public, you know, student loans, you have this idea of you graduated, you have this degree, you've made this accomplishment in your life, and now you're still struggling. And people feel ashamed. They feel like they've failed somehow. And then they kind of hide it. And you'll see where they feel like they have their student loans in order because they're making the payment or they've got them in deferment for right now or whatever. But then the rest of their financial picture is really on like a shoestring where one small change can actually throw the entire apple cart, you know, over. I think like where we get into the semantics of like defining crisis is important. I also think though too, you know, the NCES came out with a study last week, and it was one of the first long-term studies on student loan repayments. And, you know, if 38% of Americans with student loans haven't paid back a dime in 13, 14 years, like, to me, that starts to become troubling. Or if 80% of Americans say that they have student loans and it causes them significant or very, very significant amounts of stress, I mean, stress impacts, you know, there's a direct correlation between health and your financial health. And so when you're stressed about your finances, even when you do have things in order, it causes you, there's implications to that outside of just your finances. And I totally agree that higher education is a significant opportunity to rise above the economic ladder, to move up, you know. But I think there's it's not like this binary choice between free and maybe where we're at right now. It's like creating a system that actually allows people to get affordable higher education and then actually maximize moving forward their earning potential.
Annalise also thinks current student debt levels amount to a crisis. She noted that they have surpassed credit card debt in the U.S., second only to mortgages.
I just have a really hard time seeing how 43 million Americans with $1.4 trillion of debt is not a national crisis. You know, that is a significant amount of money. That is a significant number of people. You know, the study that was mentioned, and even, you know, research that One Wisconsin now is partner, One Wisconsin Institute has done, that just shows the effects that student debt has on your purchasing power for things like, you know, that we need, that, you know, on food, on cars, on, you know, housing.
All talks of a crisis aside, everyone agreed more conversations about debt and finances are a good idea. Derek talked about what UW is doing to make sure students understand their finances and what taking out a loan means.
We need to do a better job, I think all of us in higher ed, of making sure that we're putting together the best information forward to a student and to a family to give them a full picture, not just for a year, but for the lifetime of what we believe that degree will mean for the family. At UW-Madison, we've embarked on a lot of different financial literacy things. There's a financial life skills course in our School of Human Ecology, and our team partners with them to offer a holistic view to students on budgeting and life plans and things that many of us don't think about or didn't think about when we were going to college. We partner with American Student Assistance in the SALT program to give students more information about budgeting and looking at a degree and what field you'll be in and what your payments will look like given your field. There are some things that Wisconsin has put into place. Wisconsin Act 284 mandates that all institutions of higher education provide students with a full picture of their loan debt and estimated repayments, both federal, state, and private. And so we do that now. I'm not saying that that's everything we could or should do, because we definitely need to do a whole lot more, but I think it's in the right step forward. Many of our students aren't coming from families that sit down and look at budgets, and that is a part of it on the front end, is that's not necessarily every household. And many of our borrowers who end up in lots of trouble don't come from a household where they looked at a budget in the same way, for many reasons, for many various reasons, and then they're not having those habits as an adult, or they're learning them when they're under duress, when they're under financial duress.
Brad agreed, saying conversations about finances need to happen earlier.
If we just deliver financial literacy and think knowledge will solve this problem, that's not going to happen. I mean, I think, you know, humans in their nature, they need like mental incentives to follow through. You know, you can build a budget, but if you don't follow, it doesn't make a difference. And so I think we really need to sit down and talk collaboratively as a way to understand the needs of different types of people that are entering into the system, whether it's low income, high income, whatever, and understand how we could actually help them better navigate the system. One thing that that we actually did maybe a year or so ago was we actually created a closed Facebook group as like a peer support group for people. And candidly, like I don't even really know, we didn't really know what we were going to get out of that. And it's actually turned out to be a really powerful tool to kind of destigmatize the conversation. These people come from all walks of life, different areas. I mean, their commonality is essentially just debt, you know. But they've been really supportive of each other, and it's actually given us really good insights on essentially how people are feeling about it. And because these people really don't personally know these people and it's closed, they have the ability to be honest. And I think making it okay to talk about finances is probably fundamentally one of the biggest things that we can do. And I think one of the biggest things in student loans that we've noticed out of that, mainly that closed peer support group, is tied around the side of like, I wish I would have known earlier, like what this was going to cost me and then what my actual earning potential was. Because I feel like now I'm just stuck, And my decisions from when I was younger are what are causing me all this pain now.
Annalise discussed how One Wisconsin Now has taken on this issue and what they've heard from borrowers.
You know, the folks that we talk to, you know, they're really interested in, as I mentioned before, how can they lower their monthly payment? You know, how can they get a better interest rate? You know, even if we've talked to folks who have anywhere from like a 3-point-something interest rate to, you know, in the double digits. And, you know, refinancing to someone who has an 8% interest rate, you know, if they could get it down to 5, they would be saving a significant amount of money, you know, that would help them meet their other, you know, financial and life goals. So the monthly payment thing is huge. We also now are hearing a lot of anxiety over federal repayment programs. We have partnered with national organizations, the Higher Ed Not Debt Campaign, as well as Student Debt Crisis, to hold a couple of webinars on what do federal repayment programs look like right now? What are your options for, you know, helping you deal with that monthly payment? You know, what does it look like for public service loan forgiveness, things like that? And there's a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen to those programs under the new administration. And so we're dealing with, we're at this point where folks are looking for real solutions and tangible things to help them with their monthly payments, to help them with their debt. And they're seeing a lot of unknowns and, you know, what's going to happen here. You know, if this, you know, one of the things that we've heard the most, I think, is if public service loan forgiveness is canceled, my life is over. We actually had someone say that to us because folks have built their lives around these programs that, you know, the government put in place and promised to hundreds of thousands of borrowers.
The panelists also discussed the difference between college affordability and student debt, because they're distinct but related issues. Ellie said a lot of research shows a lack of state money is a key reason costs have increased so much.
There's been some pretty rigorous research that's demonstrated that state divestment from public institutions has driven up the cost of college. The other side of that, the other side of the argument, it's called the Bennett hypothesis, that the availability of federal financial aid means colleges will continue to raise prices because they know the money is there. That's still called the Bennett hypothesis because there's no research to show that that's true. So there have been a lot of folks who've made attempts to prove that the availability of federal financial aid is the cause of the increase in college unaffordability. That research has not been successful. It's difficult to do. You can't like experiment with a world that doesn't have federal financial aid available, but there's really no scientific evidence to back up that idea, whereas there is evidence that states reducing their investment in public education is driving up the cost of college.
Is there any, I guess, and Ellie, I don't know if you can speak to this too, but any research looking to, another thing I've heard a lot is like student demands now have shifted the demand, this kind of like more comprehensive, holistic programming and great dorms and all of this stuff that like...
Lazy rivers.
Yeah, like the universities have to meet in order to like lure them there and...
Yeah, so a lot of that tends to be, I see it kind of as the same thing as we're like, when we talk about student debt in the context of kids with $100,000 in debt, talking about college affordability in the context of this university in Florida who built a lazy river at their college, like that's not the problem. There's no evidence to suggest that student demands are really behind the creation of these things.
One audience member asked how older, returning, and non-traditional students fit into the conversation.
There was just recently a study that showed that the highest demographic for folks with student loan debt that's growing is the baby boomer generation, which gives me hope that we might actually then get some policy passed, considering who's in charge. But the other piece of that, I saw this firsthand. I'm from Janesville, and there were... When the GM plant closed, there were folks that I went to high school with who were in college classes with their parents and like their friends' parents. And so, you know, I think looking back at that, you know, the number of folks who were trying to afford college themselves and, you know, and then all of a sudden mom or dad has to go back to school and what that does to a family's finances. And, you know, we've heard from a number of parents, you know, it's like they can't even, they want to go back for another degree, but do they get that degree for themselves, or do they put that money into saving for their kids' college and their kids' education? It's troubling because it's, you know, do I choose this for myself? You know, do I choose this for my kid? Or do I have to go back? And therefore, you know, we're looking at trying to pay for both.
One thing that I would highlight with that, I was working at GreenPath prior to, you know, the economy kind of going down back in 2008, 2009. And one of the things that you started to see was this shift where people who were unemployed then started to think, I have to go back to work to redo my skills here because otherwise I'm not going to be able to find a job. And there was some real truth to that. I think also it put them further behind the eight ball than a lot of times when they did eventually get back to work. The other part of this, the whole, you know, parents taking out loans for their kids, like this is a significant obligation that we're starting to see on a regular basis with people trying to retire and having to work longer and longer and having to make decisions that I think they did not originally plan for. And it speaks to the value of having like a broader family discussion on whether or not you're actually going to contribute to your kids' college education, especially from a loan standpoint, because the emotional pressure I think that a lot of parents feel when their kids call them and say, hey, I have to drop out unless you take out this loan, that's a very tough decision for a lot of people to make. And that is then impacting negatively lots of people and their ability to actually then retire.
I think the biggest culprit for adult students and non-traditional students actually is the for-profit college industry. Because most of the non-traditional students in this country are being, I won't use the word served, but they are attending for-profit institutions. I'm not going to say served. And that is where a ton of the default and a ton of the debt is housed. And I think that that's largely because there was a need for it. The for-profit college industry exists because there was not another well-funded option for non-traditional and adult students. So they saw an opening and they took it. And they have been abusing that opening since.
I think like smart regulations holding schools like that responsible for the outcomes that they have is really important. There is a definitive reason why, like you said, for-profit exists. There are people that maybe their life journey doesn't include a four-year college degree, and that's okay, you know. But we need to be able to make sure they can get the skills that they can need in a responsible way that is then going to be stable with that job. You know, like these people coming out of a lot of these for-profit schools are not, you know, be making $80,000 their first year out. They might be making $25,000, and when they graduate with $50,000 in debt, that math just doesn't work.
And I think what's really unfortunate about all of that is that, you know, we were on the path to regulating them and to holding them accountable. And that has just, those regulations have been completely obliterated by Education Secretary DeVos. And that's, I think, really unfortunate for those students who need those, you know, who are looking to for-profits to, you know, potentially get them a degree that might mean something, even though, you know, for a lot of cases, employers say it doesn't. You know, which also, you know, I think, you know, to bring it back to Wisconsin, you know, Wisconsin used to have the Educational Approval Board, which was specifically in place to help regulate for-profit colleges, and that was eliminated in this last budget. And I think that's really unfortunate because this was something that existed to help, you know, sort of hold those colleges accountable, and I should say colleges in air quotes. And, you know, we saw the EAB in work when I think it was Everest College in Milwaukee was closed. Those students were able to see, you know, something come back from that, you know, after they were sort of, I guess, defrauded by this college. You know, so that is obviously a concern. And we've been told that those positions are moving and that work will continue, but, you know, haven't necessarily seen hard evidence to that yet. And then, you know, speaking to, I think, the point of having those, you know, shortened degrees and two-year degrees and night classes and things available for students, you know, we're looking at a UW system that is looking to close or integrate our two-year campuses with the four-year campuses. So an educational opportunity that used to exist in, you know, counties like Barron County or Fond du Lac, you know, or Rock County down, you know, in Janesville where I'm from, you know, that is another one of those opportunities that, you know, could see the possibility of going away, and we lose that opportunity to provide them with an education that is regulated and good by standards compared to for-profit colleges.
We wrapped up our talk by discussing whether student debt will be a campaign issue in 2018, either on the state or federal level. Everyone agreed that hopefully, as student loans affect more people, there will be more political traction to address the issue.
I think that the number of student loan borrowers in the state is growing, and the amount of debt in the state is growing, and folks are becoming increasingly frustrated with the lack of action on the student debt crisis in Wisconsin. We saw this become an issue. I think gubernatorial candidate Mary Burke back in 2014 actually took action and had some points on student debt. We've seen Senator Tammy Baldwin, she was a co-author of the federal refinancing bill with Senator Warren. It's something that, she's talked about. Our congressional candidates talk about it. Is it a campaign issue? I hope it will be. I think that we are going to reach a point where borrowers will make it a campaign issue and start demanding some sort of action for relief from their elected representatives.
I think I'm a little afraid that it will lose some political steam given everything else as a nation politically we're dealing with. And the next election, particularly the presidential election, I think we will have, of course, every candidate will make their spiel about higher education. But I'm very concerned that the state of the nation in general would suggest that there are so many things that maybe candidates will lose traction on these things that we find are important and be distracted by many other things that have grown over the last year to year and a half. So I'll be waiting and watching, I guess, like everyone else.
And I think continuous conversations like this are really important. If you look at like other topics like this, I mean, for instance, like the foreclosure crisis, the only reason why there started to be systematic change in funding and different ways of thinking was because the entire system was about to fail. And I fear that with student loans, that is probably what's going to need to happen before some people start taking it seriously. Because the levers aren't necessarily in place. If you're not feeling the pain as whatever stakeholder you are, then your idea of what the crisis is different. And so having conversations is important to push the topic and make sure we can hold people accountable for it. But I think the other part of it is unfortunately, a lot of times in America, we don't make systematic changes until there's a large crisis.
Stay tuned for more episodes this month and stories at captimes.com. Thanks again to Eric Lawrenson, who edits and mixes this podcast, and thank you for listening. I'm Caitlin Farrell.